Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, we talk about technology leading to abundance, leading to who knows what. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next. I think this is the most sci-fi episode that we've done in a while, or it could be.
It could be. I mean, I don't know. Social credit score is kind of hard to beat, but yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's start with some housekeeping on that one.
Okay.
So I don't know if you saw the email yet. I think I got it this morning, but a dear listener forwarded a tweet. I believe it was from a U.S. journalist. Yeah, traveling in China, who said that on the train, they announced that disobeying the rules of the train would decrease their social credit score, which made me wonder, is the Chinese government going to also track a social credit score for non-Chinese citizens?
That's a good question, because you said the announcement was in English.
Right.
Of course, I'm sure there are a lot of Americans living and working in China.
I suppose if you're using any of the services that are part of the deal, the sort of behind the scenes deal to feed data to the government, then I suppose you're going to be in the database one way or another. Whether you care or not, I suppose, is a different question.
What I mean, like, just like following rules on a train, that seems very granular. I mean, what are they going to does the Chinese government have a large CCTV system? I don't know. Like, are there people going to sit and review it? How does that work?
Right. I don't know. That's a great question, because it's kind of like the nosedive episode of Black Mirror, which, like, who sends the rating? Like, does the conductor be like, oh, this person got kicked off the train, and then go to some system where they, like, rate the person? Or
right. Or can other passengers rate you? Or it's yeah.
Yeah, that is, I don't know if we talked about this last time, but I think it's interesting to consider, or to, I guess, just think about, is there a difference between people who are acting or behaving nicely, air quotes, because for fear of punishment versus because they just think they should? In which gets into the, well, why does someone just think they should? Because fear of punishment that they learned as a little kid? Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Hopefully not, but maybe. If I'm interacting with a whole bunch of random strangers, I don't really care why they're being nice to me.
Right. But at the same time, well, I guess I don't, because I don't know.
Right.
But pretty quickly you would know. Here it is. Because this was pretty quickly you would wonder, is this person being nice to me because they like me? Or is this person being nice to me to increase their score? Which was a major theme of that episode.
Right.
You know, where the two friends were sort of being nice on the surface because they both had these sort of underlying motives. And then it, you know, I don't think this is a spoiler. And then it sort of like bubbles to the reality bubbles to the surface.
And everything falls apart. Yeah.
Yeah. And this sort of transactional relationship is revealed. And then I think, like, okay, for the first generation, you don't care because you're nice or whatever. It's like, right. I don't really study the laws in the US or even locally, because I'm pretty sure I'm not doing anything that's against the, like, I'm positive.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't need to know that there's a law that says I can't go out and beat someone up, because it's generally not something I'm going to do.
Right. I'm not even talking about the bad behavior where you start to get like SEO type people who are gaming the system and like, oh, if you go like this, then you'll get a higher score. And if you do this bad thing, but in this particular way, it won't ding your reputation score. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about undermining. I feel like the whole point of the thing, I mean, the whole point of the thing is to have this sort of generalized trust score, but I feel like it will undermine trust. You don't know what the motivations are.
Right. You'll never know if their motives are genuine.
Yeah, which is like, feels worse, but maybe we're just blind to the fact that all of this stuff is baked into society and now they're just exposing it in technology. I don't know, but it's coming. It's happening there, and it's only 2 years away before it's mandatory.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to keep an eye on in a few years.
It is just so hard to imagine that doing anything good. But okay, we'll see. I mean, who knows? Maybe the end will justify the means, but it sure is hard to imagine. Talk about unintended consequences.
Yeah. It feels too much like a play for social control than a measure of trust. But
yeah, yep. Ugh, yuck. Okay, now I feel gross. So let's talk about something else.
Yeah, I feel slimy.
Right. Well, there's reasons.
Well, yeah.
You actually are slimy.
I actually am. Yeah.
You want to just leave it at that, or?
Yeah, we can leave it at that.
Okay. All right, Joe. Join the mailing list to find out why Kelly's slimy. So.
The suspense.
So this is this week. I think the central player in this week's show is nanobots, and it stems from a sort of supercut of some talks that we watched between this sort of Elon Musk, Peter Diamantis, and Ray Kurzweil, so on and so forth. And it kind of mashed up this theme of a future where technology kind of meets the low bar for kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So like what happens when, let's just say, technology gets advanced enough so that the marginal cost of everything approaches zero. So after your capital expense is invested in whatever, a surgery robot or a
lab growing food. Yeah.
Once that's invested, okay, that's expensive. But once you do it and it plays out over time, the cost of one more widget, whatever the widget is, whether it's a surgery or a steak, then the cost approaches zero. And the only things involved are, what did he say? The things that are involved are like, you need electricity, mm-hmm. information, or the data to create the thing. And fudge, I'm forgetting the third one.
Oh, you're going to need some kind of like repository of atoms from which to build with.
Yes. Oh, right. The raw materials. So the thing was, I was like, yeah, the raw materials and the electricity will have a cost, but it's kind of like seeing your, I don't know, like your cell phones, anything you do with your smartphone is basically free. Like you have to pay for the phone and you have to pay for the plan, but compared to what you can do with it, it's basically free. Anything you do on top of the phone. So like the phone itself isn't free. And in fact, you know, some people listening are probably like, no, it's actually really expensive. I've got a family of five and I'm paying AT&T $500 a month.
Right.
Okay, sure. You're paying $500 a month. But if you think back 20 years, you know, that $500, the stuff that you get on top of that for free, on top of having that platform, that computing platform that's connected to the cloud in your pocket, you know, you're getting a camcorder for free that used to cost tons of money. You're getting a VCR that used to cost tons of money. You're getting a Walkman that used to cost hundreds of dollars.
You're getting international calling.
You're getting translation services. You get you could just go down the list. Anything that you had in your bedroom, dear listener, in the 80s, or that you wish you had, VCR, record player, TV, tickets to the movies, blah, 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 a bunch of games, all the games that you had, all the video games. The video games I had. Oh, man. Saved up money to go ride my little Mongoose BMX bike down to Ann and Hope and buy like the latest Atari cartridge or the latest Rush single, you know, Rush 45. Rush was a rock band. 45 was a small record. A record is a way to encode musical information that's decoded on a thing called record player. Anyway.
Yeah, those are actually making a comeback, right? And Rush should never go away to begin with.
That's so. For sure. I'm pretty sure they're robots. Neil Peart is obviously.
Obviously, yeah.
But so here, and what you're getting, the comeback of vinyl is an interesting, I think it's relevant because the premise of the video, and it's imaginable, is that you can have sort of replicators that take dirt or like just basic raw materials and decompose them into individual components or molecules and at a maybe atomic level. I don't know.
Yeah, like the factories in the Bob books.
Exactly. Right. So if they can find basic raw materials and then reconfigure them into something else, it's kind of like having a recycling plant everywhere, but that it just works immediately. So instead of like taking trucks and trucks and trucks full of mostly cardboard and plastic garbage and grinding it down into component parts and turning it into cardboard and plastic that it's in new shapes, you can kind of do that like right on your desk. And it would include metal and glass and all these other things. And so it's like, huh, you know, I think I want a Ferrari or a mansion. And then you just go stuff this hose in the dirt and it goes through the replicator and like poops out a mansion or a Ferrari or whatever.
While digging your basement.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, there's 3D printed houses. You can print a house out of cement.
Yeah.
You know, it's not.
There's laser cut ones for sure.
It's not totally bonkers. So, you know, if you start to imagine stuff at a level that is that small, it opens up a lot of possibilities. One of the things that I thought was, I thought was a little questionable was that he felt that the data would be free, was be one of those things that was virtually free. And I was like, I don't know, that seems like the expensive thing. Like that's the thing that would become expensive.
Yeah, that's the part that you have to have knowledge.
Yeah, the pattern
skills. Yeah.
So, but who knows? Maybe one person does that and it becomes like open source software. Like somebody makes this super cool, not that I think cars will even exist, but somebody makes this super cool thing and they just want to share it and they open source the plans, like, you know, like Thingiverse or whatever. People already do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
So what happens though? So like what happens to what's the meaning of life? Like if you take stuff out of your life, if we just posit that stuff becomes essentially free, the way that apps are essentially free on your phone. So like I can get a bunch of games on my phone. I can get a bunch of music on my phone. I can get all of these things on my phone or wherever, Alexa, computer, laptop, tablet. If that happens with physical stuff, let's say it does, what does that mean? So that's the big question, is what does it mean if stuff becomes free, including food?
Well, obviously for a lot of people, it's going to improve the quality of life. I mean, there's a lot of people that don't have access to quality shelter and food and clean water.
Mm-hmm.
That all needs fixed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we can even print medicine. So if you think developing countries, it's not probably, I guess it's safe to say, not a consumption society. So doesn't really, you know, so let's say they get up to, let's say developing country pretty quickly gets to first world level of capability, you know, so that's, you know, there's this magical stuff printer that, you know, maybe it's centralized or whatever. Maybe people have them in their homes, but it becomes like, hey, this food is basically free. So here, have it. So then let's say people kind of quickly get to the, let's focus on the US for the time being. So like, let's say in the US, because I mean, that's what we're most familiar with.
Yeah. And everybody else is going to come up to a certain baseline pretty quickly. I see what you're saying, where you're hitting there. So.
Yeah. So, but while I think the interesting thing is since they're leapfrog over the entire like Madison Avenue thing. So like there would be the factory phase where everything was relatively cheap and therefore there needed to be a thing called fashion so that you would throw out perfectly good jeans after a year. So I don't think that it would, I think it would have a very different impact in a place that didn't follow the path like the US followed. But so let's just say the US is like, all right, so the keeping up with the Joneses thing, and we were reading an article earlier about, you know, this effect of, you know, as soon as you have one nice thing, it makes all of your other things look shabby. So you have a tendency to want to buy more things to go with the one nice thing. And then now all of a sudden it's this circular
like vicious cycle of buying stuff.
Yeah. That's nicer and nicer and nicer. And it almost never, very rarely does it go down. The only time I ever see anybody go down in the US, go down the consumption cycle is when their kids go to college or kids graduate from college and it's finally, you know, it's back to the two parents and they're like, hey, let's go live in Costa Rica. Let's sell the house. Let's sell all the stuff, do the bucket list thing and downsize and all that stuff. But other than that, people my age anyway, I just do not see people downsizing or degrading the, you know, it's like, hey, honey, let's stop buying good stuff that we're used to and start buying cheap stuff. It doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. Yeah, you may make a decision to buy less stuff, but you're not gonna like decide to buy the lower quality things. And this is something I struggle with. Like my desire to own less things is constantly at war with my desire to have all the cool stuff.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's like our house. I feel like our house, you know, we get this impulse periodically. It's like, oh, we should really move to a bigger house. And it's like, well, we could just get rid of some stuff, but there's this weird, but you know, like we, in occasion, like once a year, we'll be like, yeah, we should get rid of, you know, anything that we haven't worn in a year, we should donate to Salvation Army, or all the, you know, the clothes that don't even fit the kids anymore, we should give to other people who have smaller kids, or we should get rid of these toys that nobody plays with. But I think in the scheme of things, on the scale, I'm pretty good at getting rid of stuff. I'm worse at it than I used to be, but I used to live in my van. So I'm like really good at getting rid of stuff. I've gotten more sentimental as I get older. So there's certain things that I hold on to for dumb reasons.
Yeah, same here. And I'm better at it than the other two thirds of my family.
Yeah, I mean, Cooper, like he is at a stage, or maybe it's just his personality, where he feels like a kind of an empathetic connection with stuff. So if you put it by the side of the road, he'll like break into tears.
Like feel bad for the stuff.
He feels bad for the stuff, right? Like one time we put a couch out by the road and we were like, oh, we're going to recycle it. We're going to donate it to, you know, somebody else who wants it. And an old school garbage truck came by to pick it up. And when they were like, oh, cool. Look, they're going to recycle it. And they cracked the thing in half and like, you know, broke it into a million pieces and jammed it in the truck.
Right.
Horrified. That was the dog's couch. I mean, we have a dog's couch. The reason we threw out the old one is because we got a new one.
For the dog.
So anyway, okay, so there's this thing that seems pretty, I think most people listening are going to be nodding along like, yeah, there's this thing where you buy more stuff and you have too much stuff. And I'm sure there's some folks in the audience, especially, I notice it a lot with developers where they're like, no, I've just got my three perfect things and I, you know, my everyday carry and those are all my things. And that's cool. It doesn't seem to click with an actual family, but maybe I'm just projecting.
There's a lot about that mentality that I like, but I, as much as I want to on some level adapt it, I have a really hard time doing so. And I mean, part of it is that, yeah, it doesn't adapt well to family, but at the same time, I could be like, okay, family can do whatever they want to do. This one room, this one space is mine to do with as I want. And even then it never ends up as minimal and simple as I would ideally like for it to be. But at the same time, I don't want it to be different than what it is.
Right. Yeah. It's like an internal conflict. I'm the same way with my office. So like I've had an office for about a year and a half, 2 years now, and I have done a pretty good job not accumulating a ton of stuff. And there's one big thing in there that I'm definitely, I just need to figure out how to get rid of it. Not sure how, but I'm going to for sure. And other than adding books, I haven't violated my principles. Okay. But we're just sort of talking about stuff in general. Now what happens, given that seems to be a pretty common human behavior to accrete, like for more stuff to accrete to your existing stuff. And as you get nicer stuff, you want nicer stuff to go with it. Let's say that that's common. What happened when stuff's basically free?
I would probably redecorate my house on like a monthly basis.
Interesting. And what, okay, let's assume for the sake of argument that you could take the old stuff and it wasn't just going to a landfill.
You could recycle it to make the new stuff.
Yeah. It's weird. I don't even know how to think about it. Like, I guess, so one thing, we would have less stuff. I know we would have less stuff because a huge portion of the stuff we have is like seasonal.
Right.
We have crates and crates, and I'm not kidding you, dozens of them with Christmas ornaments and extension cords and stuff that all the stuff we use because we host around 30 people for Thanksgiving, all the dishes that you need for 30 people for one dinner a year. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to throw that stuff out every time and rebuy it. And it's not even so much the money as the inconvenience of having to go buy it again.
Right. And how much stuff do you have laying around your house that you don't use every day? And maybe you haven't used it in 6 months, but you keep it because eventually someday you might need it.
Yeah, exactly. And so if it was like, oh, I could just print out a ratchet set or something like that.
Right.
Or even if there was like a shared, you could imagine like a shared repository of certain things, like one lawnmower for the neighborhood or something like that. But if even just thinking about for us, like decorative stuff, that's the bulk of it. It's like all this, 'cause it takes up a ton of space. Mm-hmm. It's relatively light, but it's kind of delicate, takes up a lot of space. The dishes, the decorative stuff. We've got like an entire basement full of that stuff that we could get rid of if it was like, oh, it's Thanksgiving. How many people do you have? Oh, 25 people this year. Great. Okay, so what do we want the tablescape to look like? Let's design the tablescape. And then we go online and we pick out something super crazy that's based on like a, I don't know, like a tribal tattoo and, you know, like a who knows what. It'd be like, and just like create it and create this sort of fanciful experience. And then after it's done, grind it back into the everyday stuff. I don't know. I think it would kind of be cool.
Yeah, it would be. And yeah, you're right. There could be a lot less clutter. And also, I don't think you would get as attached to your stuff. Like the sentimental value you place on items that you're keeping around just because they have some sentimental value, I don't think you would care as much.
Oh, yeah. So it's, yeah, it kind of reminds me of when I used to own physical albums. And I remember laughing like, oh, pff, I'll never not own my music. You know what I mean? And now, like, having moved probably thousands of records over the course of my lifetime, multiple times. Records are heavy and they get destroyed and all of that. You know, streaming music, I'm totally cool with. I'm not saying that there's no difference, but the idea of buying access to what used to be my stuff, you know, kind of renting access to stuff in general is... I'm tempted to say, oh, I wouldn't like it, but I know that I've said that before about other things and it turned out to be actually fine and even a little better in a lot of ways. So yeah, I mean, Kevin Kelly talks about this in The Inevitable. He talks about having like a, he doesn't even get into the nanobot stuff. He's just like, you're going to have a box outside of wherever you live where stuff shows up.
Right. And then you put other stuff in it when you're done.
Yeah, you put your, when you're done with that outfit for the prom, you just throw it back in there and somebody else gets it. It's not the only way that things work, but something that you can do, something you can participate in where there's this kind of, it's more of a subscription to, it's not a subscription really. It's more like a membership to a shared pool of stuff that is hyper convenient to access and discard.
Like that one time of year that I need a sewing machine.
Right. So, and that's another great example, like Erica's sewing stuff. She'll go on a tear like maybe twice a year for a week. She'll go on like a wicked sewing tear. The rest of the time, all that stuff is just like collecting cobwebs in the basement. And it takes up a lot of space. And that the fact that all our space is taken up makes you feel cramped in your house. It's like, it's weird. I mean, I wonder if that sort of...
Would we all live in smaller houses?
Right. Like, would that stop that cycle of I need more stuff? Because it's not even like the article we read, it wasn't even about, it had nothing to do with keeping up with the Joneses, actually. It was really just about like, oh, now I've got this nice thing. I should get these accessories for it to, because it's almost like it deserves them. Or if I'm going to make this big investment, I might as well make these 16 small investments.
Yeah. And I've certainly done that. It's like, well, if we're going to spend that much money to get this thing, we might as well get this other stuff that goes with it. At the same time, though, I know a lot of people who just, I don't know, they seem to like acquiring stuff for the sake of acquiring stuff. And I don't mean like you buy something and then it's like, oh, I want something else nice to go with it. But I mean, it's like people that just like go out and shop and buy things without putting any thought to like, do I need this item?
So, yeah, I think the shopping thing, I think there's a dopamine thing going on there.
Yeah, I think there probably is.
Because it feels like, and I'm not immune to this in other realms, but it feels a lot like a gambling thing. It's like, or like the social media addiction or something like that. And I do know people that like to, it comes across as bragging. Maybe it's not bragging, but it comes across that way to me. They like to talk about their... Oh yeah, like we got an ATV and, you know, and a jet ski and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, you don't even have room for it. I feel like you can't afford it. You know, like it just looks like a giant credit card bill to me. So I'm certainly not impressed by it, but maybe they have friends that are impressed by it, and, or maybe they're not bragging. Maybe there's something else going on that they actually use the things. I know they don't, but I don't know. I don't know. It's weird.
No, I feel like there's a lot of people, and I'm not immune to this. I don't think I do it to a large degree, but I'm not immune to it. But there's a lot of people that I feel like they get some of their self-worth is based on the stuff they own.
Yeah, that's got to be true. It has to be. But so what happens when stuff's free? Like, will that change? I think it will, because you would immediately become buried in all the stuff you print it out or however it comes into being. So perhaps it would make us more thoughtful about the kind of things we didn't keep recycling. Maybe the stuff that actually matters, stuff that's super nostalgic, or the stuff that's
like passed down from great grandma.
Yeah, like the antique watch, maybe that sort of those sorts of things, that sort of stuff becomes much more valuable, which leads us right into something you raised before we jumped on the call, which is so interesting, where you were like, you said something along the lines, or do you remember?
Yeah, you were like, well, what if I want a Ferrari and you could just like press a button and a Ferrari gets made? And it's like, you know, I feel like a Ferrari is something you should have to work for.
Why?
It's hard to articulate. I think, well, on the one hand, I think it's sort of in.
Right.
I think some people need the incentive to like have a goal to work for. Like, what's the incentive to get up and do this thing every day when I can make whatever I want at the push of a button? Why should I go to my job every day? But at the same time, I think there's, you know, well, you're just making me realize that my initial thought on this was buying something that you worked for. It's kind of like the reward at the end. It's like, you know, it's a thing that you can be proud of, that like you worked hard and now you can get this thing.
Yep. What happens when there are no more rewards of that kind? So it's almost like we're going to need some of it to be expensive. Or, okay, now we're getting somewhere. What you just described is a Ferrari is rare because it's so expensive. So not that many people can afford it. So you don't see them around all the time. If everybody could print out a Ferrari, it wouldn't be special anymore. I mean, I'm sure the experience of driving one would still be a rush for, you know, people who are into that kind of thing, you know, like a, you know, it just physically feels fun, I suppose, like just the acceleration and whatnot. But I don't think that's the main, I don't get the sense that that's the main reason, but I'm not a car guy, so maybe I'm wrong. But what becomes rare when stuff is free? So like, here's a quick story. When my stepfather owns a used bookstore. So he, like, talk about dealing with atoms, like he is in an atoms business. So, and who would even bother? Like, why would anybody, how could he be in business for 30 years? Like, why would anybody go in there?
Right, when you can get anything on your Kindle.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of them for free, especially the old stuff. So when he was making the leap, and let me tell you, he didn't want to, you know, because he's a used books guy. He, when he started making the tech leap and making stuff, titles available on Amazon and other, you know, actually there was a precursor to Amazon. I can't even remember the name of it, Ex Libris or something like that. And he would list stuff online. And what they used to have to do, what a bookseller used to have to do was they would, you know, first of all, they were well known. They needed to be well known in the area. So when somebody's professor parent died and had his huge library of books, he would call him in, he would go through them, he'd give him a price, he'd buy the books, he'd take them away, he'd price them, he'd go through all the manual, blah, 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 blah. It was like a huge manual process. And you put them on the shelves. And then every once in a while, you'd come across something that was pretty rare, something unusual. So, you know, not Danielle Steele, but like, you know, Profiles in Courage by JFK, like first edition signed. And you'd be like, wow, this is worth, you know, it's not even how much is it worth. How much could I get for this in Providence, Rhode Island? So he would put a price on it, and it was sort of like, it was based on a lot of things, but this is very, very early. This is like Netscape era internet. So there wasn't a lot of data, global access to data. So what they used to do, booksellers, used booksellers, is they would pack up all their stuff, probably quarterly, all of their really good stuff. And they'd go to these book shows, and they were basically conventions for book people where people would bring really cool stuff, and they'd set up, and they were all, you know, it was fairly regional. It wasn't like global. People, you know, booksellers didn't fly in from all over the world. So you'd load up the Astro van, drive up to Boston, set up the table, do all this stuff. It'd be raining. I mean, everything, like, you know, set up all that stuff, and boom, people would walk through for 3 days. And then, you know, the whole time the booksellers would be like, oh, I can't believe it rained. Attendance is really down. Or, geez, the first day was really the busiest. I should have sold, you know, I should have taken that money from that guy. Even, you know, he tried to talk me down. I should have taken it because now nobody's here. You know, it's like this, it's just this constant, all of the conversation and all of the stuff that went on around getting the books to market was almost the bigger deal. It was like, it was something that people would try to not game, but like get good at, and all of these like idiosyncrasies and nuances just to sell Profiles in Courage.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's wild.
So now, you know, then, you know, fast forward from there, maybe 5 years. So he starts to, you know, he's got about half of his titles online. And I was like, what do you, has that hurt sales? You know, like, is that good? And he's like, it's weird. It has, he goes, what, to make a long story longer, he said, what he saw happen once the more the internet became a thing, a normal thing, the web really, once the web started to become a thing, and then certainly once Amazon was on the scene, the stuff that was not really that rare, but hard to find locally, the cost went to zero. Mm-hmm. So stuff that was like kind of rare in New England that you used to be able to get $150 for now was $10.
Right, because you could order it anywhere else on the internet.
Yeah, and have it in 2 days. Mm-hmm. So if there were 100 copies across the United States, you had a lot of competition. But a truly rare book that used to go for $1,000, you could get 50,000 for it because you were making it available to buyers all over the world. So when you had, you know, so like some Saudi prince would buy like a signed copy, like JFK, President of the United States, signed this copy of this book that he wrote. So the stuff that's truly globally rare became way, way more valuable to people. Or I should say, the market was exponentially bigger for that particular kind of a book. So the awareness was higher.
Pockets were deeper on the other side of the world.
Exactly. Pockets were deeper. So you had access to deeper pockets. And therefore, you know, it was kind of a, not a bidding war, but that kind of thing, like the prices that you could get for stuff that was truly rare. Okay. So long, long story, but what it reminds me that our conversation reminds me of that because stuff that's somehow truly rare, stuff that can't be printed, presumably would become astronomically valuable. So if you can't print a Ferrari, then they'll be worth more than they are now, I would think.
Yeah, that's a good point. They would be.
And the value of stuff that, you know, the hand-me-down watch, heirloom type stuff, I suppose would be in that category. That feels like cheating though.
Yeah, it does feel like cheating. Stuff that was created before you could print stuff.
Yeah. Well, okay. So this gets back to the vinyl, the resurgence of vinyl. So it's almost like, because I don't know that much about it. I should, because I'm, you know, one of those people and a musician. But to me, the resurgence of vinyl is cool for, I'm trying to think who I know that is into that. I'm sorry to say they're all a little bit like older. Is it a hipster thing? Like, do hipsters go to record stores? Is it like a millennial thing, or is it just a bunch of 40 somethings now that have the money and the roots put down?
I think it's a millennial thing.
Interesting. I mean, the sound quality is better. I can promise you that, but the inconvenience level is through the roof.
I wonder if the sound quality is better if you're then compressing it and piping it through Bluetooth speakers, which I think a lot of people do.
Well, I'm thinking of one particular friend who's the type of person who builds his own speakers mm-hmm. because the ones you can buy aren't good enough.
I will admit to having done that in the past.
So I don't think he's listened to anything over Bluetooth, but it does seem like I'm trying to figure out if the vinyl, I feel like it might be an experience. So like, it's not just about having the record. It's the whole thing. Like, I own this record collection. I have this ritual where, you know, I do these things at a particular time and I get my bourbon, I put 2 ice cubes in it and I sit down and the door is closed and everybody knows not to bother me. And I listen to live Hendrix or I listen to this thing or whatever it is. And it's this whole ritual around, you know, in all of the things that come with it, like building your own speakers and shopping for the best headphones and soundproofing the room and setting up the rules with the family about not interrupting or whatever it is.
Yes. Yes. I remember those rules my father had.
Right. So yeah. It seems like the experience.
It's like people are buying it for the experience rather than just like, because it's the end thing. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure some people are buying it because it's the end thing, but yeah. And here we have come full circle because for Christmas, I almost got Kira a turntable and some Rush albums.
I keep Red Barchetta keeps popping into my head too, which if people don't know that song, I won't go into it, but just Google Red Barchetta. And it's like, it reminds me of this. I don't know if we can top Red Barchetta. So I think I got to say, it would, on balance, I think it would be by far net good if stuff was basically
free. I think so. I think we'd have to, I mean, if we weren't recycling our stuff and just getting buried in stuff, then that would be bad. And I do think some people would be prone to that. And I think I know a couple people who would be prone to that. But at the same time, if you can just like remanufacture anything you need, there's no real incentive to keep it around either. So, you know, maybe it wouldn't be a big problem.
Yeah, super cool. Well, nanobots, we shall see. And perhaps next week we can talk about nanobots being injected into your bloodstream, not yours specifically, yours, dear listener, by the Chinese government.
You too can be slimy. No, all wait. Right.
Yeah, not to miss those show notes. All right, have we made any progress? Did we figure anything out?
I doubt it. I think we just kind of rambled for 42 minutes and 45 seconds.
Yeah, I don't know. I got one answer, which was I was looking for the reason you thought it was important to work for a Ferrari.
I just think it's important to have goals to work
right,
for.
Right. You see a Ferrari as a reward. Yep. For hard work. Yeah.
And maybe that's shallow. Maybe your rewards for hard work shouldn't be stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I had this conversation with somebody the other day. It's not a futurist conversation, but it was like a pricing thing. It's like, well, stuff that's easy to do should be worth less than stuff that's hard to do. And we got into, you know, this is like someone from a coal mining town who's used to hard physical labor. And it took a while to figure out how we were talking past each other, but
had different ideas about the difficulty of doing things.
Right. Like to him, hard work is synonymous with suffering, physical suffering. And I was like, but you use tools for stuff, right? So shouldn't you not use the tools so your suffering is increased? It didn't make sense, because what I was saying was like, over time, I'm like, well, it's hard work to do, like just say consulting, or it's hard work to, you know, perform a sonata, or it's hard work to, you know, whatever, any performing art, anything. But the work that you do is all, or it's all done ahead of time. It's like all preparatory work and it's hard. And he's like, well, what if you enjoy it? It
doesn't matter.
What does to him? So I was like, so there were, two things going on. We haven't gotten to the bottom of it, but it's been a fascinating conversation. But one of the things is that he equates the amount of suffering with the value to the other party, which straight up I disagree with. Like that is like Marx's labor theory of value, and it's completely wrong. So that's not me saying it. It's been debunked by economists. But he is cool. He's fine with using tools that are physical in nature, but he didn't seem to think that creating mental tools counted.
Huh.
Right. And we haven't even, that's where I think the conversation's going. We haven't gotten there yet, but that's why I was so interested in your like, well, a Ferrari should be hard to get. And I was like, what do you mean by hard? Why? So, and as a reward. So like, what happens if you take all the rewards, those sorts of rewards away? Hopefully, we'll have more meaningful rewards.
Yeah. As in like, oh, I put in all this hard work to finish this thing. So now I get to take an extra 2 days off to spend with the family.
Yeah. Like what happens if you can spend 7 days a week with your family and you can have all the stuff you need to live for free? Where do you get your rewards from? It has to be from service to others. I mean, like what possibly else could there be?
I think our brains are wired to, I don't know necessarily need reward, but I think certainly in a way we benefit from it, of having that reward after doing a thing.
Well, I think it's a sort of younger version of achieving meaning. So like, mm-hmm. like when you're younger, a reward is like a placeholder for meaning. And as you get older, I think a little bit more direct drink from the meaning fire hose is important.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And when I say reward, I mean, you know, sometimes like doing a job really well is its own reward.
Yeah, sure. It's kind of off topic for us, but yeah. it was a fascinating sort of intersection between sort of two parts of my brain. So I wanted to see what it was. It's going to be, it seems like, you know, so just to maybe wrap up, this stuff isn't really like the futurists, the people who are like involved with the science behind stuff like this. None of them are really debating whether or not it's going to happen. They're kind of like, is it going to be 2030 or 2050?
Yeah, it's all when.
Barring an asteroid strike, it's like, well, man, how do you prepare for that? Wild. All right, should we put a fork in it?
Yeah, probably so.
Okay, that's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we hope you join us again next week for Terrifying Robot Dog. Bye.